This episode is brought to you by the Sexton Single Malt Irish Whiskey, the best-selling Irish single malt in the U.S. The Sexton is an unexpected modern malt for the everyman, rich in hue, approachable in taste, and memorable in character. Learn more at thesexton.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup. This week, we're celebrating Pride. We speak to the bakers who created a custom wedding cake for Charlie Craig and David Mullins, the couple behind the Masterpiece Cake Shop Supreme Court case.
We felt that what happened to Charlie and David was an absolute injustice.
Kat Johnson addresses the controversy surrounding Anthony Porowski, Queer Eye's food and wine expert.
Many viewers thought these recipes were unsophisticated.
And finally, Hannah Forden speaks with nutrition educator Leah Kurtz about the relationship between veganism and queer identity.
It's an interesting way in which food can challenge invisible value systems even greater than sexuality does.
Listen to Meat and Three, that's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, this week, and celebrate Pride with HRN. Available on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and your favorite listening apps.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm your host, Kathy Arroway. It is a beautiful, gorgeous, sunny Brooklyn day here, and it also happens to be Father's Day. So I'm really thankful to be joined by a very hardworking dad. And he's not only a proud dad, he is the chef owner of 610 Magnolia, Milkwood, and Whiskey Dry in Louisville, Kentucky. And you may have seen him on his Emmy Award-winning PBS series, The Mind of a Chef. He's also the author of an acclaimed cookbook called Smoke and Pickles. And his latest book is an incredible culinary journey memoir, you could say. And it is called Buttermilk Graffiti. So thanks so much for joining us, Chef Edward Lee.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for taking some time away. So, you know, we talk a lot about the challenges of being, you know, a working mom today in America. But what do you think is the biggest challenge for being a working dad?
You know, it's trying to balance, work and life and being a father. Just the days of like having a kid and then passing it on to your wife to raise is not the way we do things anymore, I guess. I try and be really involved in my kids' life and I make time, I take time out of my work and my life to make sure that we're a family and that we create memories and do fun things. And we were out blueberry picking yesterday.
Oh, fun.
In the blazing sun. I'm sunburned all over.
That's good. I'm glad you found the time. And do you guys cook now? Because your little one is not too little.
Oh, she's a great. Yeah, she's five. She's really into food. She's really good. I mean, she can do some pretty cool stuff at five. She knows flavors, and we we cook a lot of omelets together. We bake a lot together. She's very particular about her fish. We do. We go to the seafood market here in D.C. and we get live crawfish, and it's the only, of course, a daughter of a chef. She instead, those they become her, play toys.
Wow!
So I just kind of set her up in the dining room table, and she has like 30 crawfish that are her little Lego toys.
You know, she's a daughter of a chef when you say she's very particular about her fish. She's 5 years old. So that's super fun. Thanks so much for taking the time on this Father's Day to chat about this amazing book. But before we get into it, it's been about a week since Anthony Bourdain passed. And on the day that the news broke, you wrote a very moving essay on CNN.com. I can only imagine how eager you must have been to honor his memory and his legacy. What was that day like for you?
It was weird. It was, it was weird because everyone was talking about suicide because of the Kate Spade thing. So it was kind of, it was just a weird discussion that was already sort of happening, and then I don't know. I woke up and my wife told me, and then, you know, your initial reaction, well, that's a hoax. You know, I mean, there's. Yeah. I actually woke up one morning to an article that I was dead. So I was like, you know, these things go around all the time.
Really? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so just you know, it just takes a while for it to sink in, and it was odd because I was actually writing. I was in the process of writing him a thank you note.
Oh my gosh!
Because he had written a nice blurb for Buttermilk Graffiti.
Yeah.
And you know, I just like got done with book tour, and I was just kind of like, you know, sitting down and some of the stuff I had sort of had in my head, because I was like, you know, we met many years ago, and you've been always very nice to me. And I just wanted to write a thank you note. And when that happened, I don't know. My agent was like, oh, CNN wanted to, you know. See if you had any opinions, and I don't know. I just sort of wrote that in like a half hour and sent it off, and it was interesting. And I really didn't have anything to, you know, like all these people try to call me afterwards and wanted to do interviews and stuff. And I just said, you know, I kind of said, I really don't want it to be, you know, I think everyone has their own Anthony Bourdain story, because he touched so many lives and meant so many different things to so many different people. And it's interesting to see that outpouring of love. I just don't think you get that, you know, obviously under terrible circumstances, but you don't get that many people who come out and
wow, yeah,
are just universally adored that man and his talents. It was sad and beautiful at the same time. You know, whenever something like that happens, that God, how many people came out and just, you know, were in tears or remembrances and tributes.
Yeah, it just that's a good way of putting it. Sad and beautiful and moving at the same time. And it seems like his writing, is that an inspiration for you as a writer?
You know, in some form, everything he did was an inspiration for me. You know, I'm not, I don't model my career after his, but for sure, I mean, you know, a chef who writes, there's not, that's not a huge category.
That's true, yeah.
So, you know, whether it's him or Gabrielle or you know, anyone who sort of puts pen to paper, it to me, you know, we lost a great one.
Yeah. Well, your book is truly great. I want to talk a lot more about this because Buttermilk Graffiti, this is your first memoir. So before you had written a cookbook, but this one really is a travel memoir. So it's travel writing, but also food writing. I love the title. You write that it's sort of like a combination of your upbringing in New York City, so graffiti, and where you live now for the past 15 years in the South. So it's very evocative. But for those who haven't checked out this book so far, you travel to some places that most foodies wouldn't really have on their radar as like an amazing culinary destination, right? I'm talking places like Dearborn, Michigan, Lowell, Massachusetts, etc. And but what they do have in common is an amazing sort of emerging immigrant cuisine, which you write about. You know, the subtitle is A Chef's Journey to Discover America's New Melting Pot Cuisine. My first question is, like, as a chef, why stick to America? I mean, you could have gone anywhere, right?
Yeah. You know, to me, right, so I'm the son of Korean immigrants. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've lived in Brooklyn and I've lived in the American South. And, excuse me, I'm fighting a cold.
Bless you.
And I've always... you know, I've always struggled with my identity as an American. Mm-hmm. And you know, I don't mean struggle in like a terrible way, but you know, we try and find our place in this narrative of American history. And equally so, because I cook sort of Asian food and I cook Southern food, which, you know, there's a bit of a dichotomy there.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always kind of thinking about, well, where do I fit into this narrative? You know, mm-hmm. who am I? And the more I ask those questions of myself, the more I realize that everyone goes through that same conflict mm-hmm. or struggle or question, where we do go, well, okay, who am I? And maybe if you've been in this country for generations, you have a bit more of a solid foundation on which to build on.
Mm-hmm.
But you also sort of look through history and you look at yourself and you look at, you know, all the hyphenated, I'm British, Scottish, French, Italian,
okay, yeah.
you know, mm-hmm. you kind of see those identities. And I think the big burning question for all Americans, because we are all from somewhere else, is, you know, who are we? What are we? And I think those questions to me are fascinating mm-hmm. When you start to kind of peel back layers and you start to understand the identity crisis that we have. And you start to go, okay, well, you know, let's look at it from, you know, you can look at it from food or arts or history. And I just tend to look at it from the lens of food because that's what I know best. And obviously that's my passion. So when we, and it's also very revealing when you look at someone's, you know, food that they serve at the table, when you look at someone's diet, when you look at someone's legacy and their history, and especially immigrants, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they come over and they lose everything, right? They lose mm-hmm. their ties to their homeland. They lose usually money. They mm-hmm. lose, you know, sometimes their you know, their language, even their clothing, you know, yeah. everything about them they lose. And for many of them, the one thing that they hold on to very, very passionately is their food, their recipes. And that, for many of them, are the traditions that connect them to the homeland. And it's a very powerful thing to be connected to. So like, when you know, I go to that Afghan restaurant, it's not just about the food. Like, mm-hmm. I'm sort of, you're getting a window into this person's culture and history, and is also his very own personal connection to his homeland. And I found that story to be really compelling, yeah. and I just wanted to write a book about it.
Yeah, and the stories behind why are they doing this? You know, what made them decide to open a restaurant, which is not mm-hmm. exactly the most, you know, definite slam dunk way to make money. You know, these stories that you capture are fascinating. One thing I want to point out is that you seem to also capture this really evolving, this ephemeral snapshot of a cuisine in a certain time and place that is bound to change. Because
mm-hmm.
you write, you know, in one chapter about going to a Uyghur restaurant in Brighton Beach, mm-hmm. Which is a place very close to where you grew up in Canarsie. But you write, you know, how long before the children of Youssef, who is the chef of this place, decide that the Lagman soup needs to be more mainstream? Do you think that essentially the story of all cuisines that are more established in America sort of becomes more mainstream?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It does, and I like the way you described the snapshot, because it you know, this thing is in constant motion. And it's one of the things that I've always found about food and about food writing and history, that, you know, we're trying to do something impossible, mm-hmm. Which is we're trying to capture a moment in time as it's actually changing at the very moment that we're writing about it. If anything, there's nothing in food that stays the same for very long. And so, you know, when I wrote this book, it is, you know, a snapshot of America and what I thought, you know, our cuisine looked like in 2017 in all these small towns across America. And you know, for every time we gain something, we lose something.
Right. Right?
So when that, you know, traditional, you know, Chinese dish becomes more accessible to Americans, and maybe the business starts going better, and there's more customers, and they get a website, and you know, they start promoting themselves on Facebook, they lose something too.
Okay.
And the question is, I guess, is the gain worth the loss? I never believe that it's an improvement or a desecration. You know, it's just like things change. You can't be afraid of the future.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, you try and preserve the past as best you can.
Right.
And America's the, you know, in many ways, America's still the wild, wild west, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are things being done to Korean food in America that you just would not do in Korea, or it evolves in maybe a different way. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I always tell the story of, like, you know, I don't know, I think I was in L.A. or Chicago, and eating a bibimbap wrapped in a burrito, and you know, every ounce of my identity and being wanted to hate this thing, and I bit into it and I was like, "Yeah, it's not bad. I mean, this is
right. It's
a pretty good lunch." And so we you know, we tend to sort of scoff at some things, while at the same time we sort of applaud other innovations. Unfortunately, you know, history doesn't work like that. It just keeps evolving. It just keeps pushing and pressing on. And you know, we're kind of at the mercy of it. And, and we sort of have to, like, look at it as a whole. And you know, I was very, you know, it's most of the chapters are about sort of new or recent immigrants coming into the country. But there are a couple of chapters on much older established immigrants, right? So I talk about German food.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And what happened to German food? What happened to this incredibly complex, beautiful, delicious cuisine that has just kind of gone away? And we don't have the great German chef, and we don't have the great German restaurants that we should.
So that's an example of loss, then.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's pros and cons. It's time for a quick little commercial interlude, but I want to talk a lot more about this subject right when we're back.
I'm Souther Teague of Moria Margo and co-host of The Speakeasy on Heritage Radio Network. This episode is brought to you by the Sexton Single Malt Irish Whiskey, a new and unexpected modern malt for the everyman. The whiskey is made from 100% Irish malted barley, triple distilled for smoothness in copper pot stills, and consciously aged for 4 years in Oloroso sherry butts. My favorite part about the Sexton is that sherry influence from those Oloroso sherry butts. They're the large sherry barrels that have been used, and then the whiskey gets aged in them for 4 years, giving them this sort of nutty, almost savory quality. The copper pot still makes for extremely smooth finish. I like it in a highball or just neat. Every time I have a sip, I want another one. So next time you're gathered with friends or posted up at your favorite bar, reach for the Sexton, the best-selling Irish single malt in North America. You can learn more at thesexton.com.
All right, we're back chatting more with Chef Edward Lee and Dad Edward Lee. Happy Father's Day again. And his latest book is called Buttermilk Graffiti, A Chef's Journey to Discover America's New Melting Pot Cuisine. So, Chef, you were just talking about how the evolution of ethnic cuisines in America is always happening in different stages, as you explore in this book, with newer immigrants all the time. But where do you sort of draw the line between taking, you know, you write that as a chef, you're always sort of mining for traditions from other cultures and making them more palatable in your cooking. Is there a point where that is done in bad taste, in your opinion?
Well, it's always done. It's always done in bad taste. And that's, doing something in good or bad taste is just one person's opinion, right?
So, yeah.
When I go to my friend's restaurant and I wait for him to go to the bathroom, and then I rifle through his recipe books and steal his recipes, like, that's in bad taste. But I'm going to do it anyway because I want the damn recipes. It's sort of culinary appropriation is something that we throw around a lot. And I have two opinions about it. I get it. And I think what I see, especially in these stories that I wrote about, these immigrants come over and they lose everything. Mm-hmm. They lose so much, and they sacrifice families, so much. Yeah. And for many of them, the one thing they get to claim as their own, the one thing they get to hold so dearly, that goes back generations, are these recipes and are these traditions and are these foods. And then next thing you know, someone's got a taco truck, right? And they're sort of abusing the tradition. And so I understand how frustrating that can be.
Yeah.
But at the same time, all food is culturally appropriated. All food, everything that you've ever put in your mouth,
it's inevitable,
came from some other place. All arts are culturally appropriated. You know, we as human beings, we are naturally curious, and we go out and we explore and we travel and we eat and we, you say appropriate, I say influence. You know, we're influenced by so many things, and we come back, and it's our natural desire to sort of be inquisitive and share and stuff. Do you want to do it in good taste? Yeah. Is everyone going to be doing it in good taste? No.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you can't stop progress, and you can't stop things being culturally influenced by each other. Mm-hmm. If you live in a neighborhood that is predominantly Latino, you are going to be influenced by that culture. It is impossible not to. And so when you start to cook that food, I moved down to Louisville, Kentucky 16 years ago from Manhattan. I did not cook Southern food for at least a year.
Okay.
Or was using any kind of Southern ingredients for at least a year or two when I moved to the American South. But it is impossible when you're surrounded by country ham and you're surrounded by sorghum, you're surrounded by all these different traditions. It's impossible to go, I'm just going to block that out and just cook in isolation. So whether one person may call it culturally appropriating, another person may just say, listen, that's a natural osmosis of culture being passed through each other. It just happens. I always, whenever people have a question about that, I get it. It's something that we all have to work on, and hopefully we have meaningful dialogues and we exchange information in a truly meaningful and respectful way.
Right.
But the alternative is, what if you were only allowed to cook the food of your own ethnicity? That would be boring.
It's very limiting.
You're very limiting. And that's the very definition of racism, right? Like, you can't do anything other than the race that you were born with. I mean, that's the very definition of sort of discrimination. And
right.
So to me, I always liken it to documentaries or you look at any other popular culture thing, right? You have, and at one point you have great shows like Chef's Table and you have Mind of a Chef. But at the same time you have, the Kardashians. And sort of reality shows. They're both kind of documentaries, and so you have to take the good with the bad. And for us as the public, you just get to choose I'm just going to tune out that stuff. We have incredible versions of Mexican food, being sort of celebrated and elevated throughout the country. And we still have this thing called Taco Bell, that is like the best-selling Mexican restaurant in the country, if one even calls it Mexican. But we also have to accept that both exist in parallel worlds. We can't also sort of sit on our high horse and only you know, expect that the beautiful, meaningful, and you know, respectful traditions are the ones that get passed on.
Right.
There's also a whole other side to food that is, you know, trash. But they exist. I mean, they fulfill a need.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not like we're going to sit on our hands and not try out something, but hopefully the good outweighs the bad and the ways that, you know, we've seen deliciousness evolve through this process that you're describing is hopefully all for the better eventually.
Yeah. And, it's, and you know, I think to me the biggest thing right now in a culture that we have that's, you know, meaningful and you know, sensitive and culturally we're very aware
right
now more than ever. But I do think that it's still really important for chefs especially to take risks,
mm-hmm,
and to fail, mm-hmm, and to make decisions that maybe aren't the best, but you know, we that's how we grow, you know, mm-hmm, we don't grow by taking the safe spot all the time. Like we go out there and we push, and you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you're good. Like I would hate for anyone not to take a chance on something at the risk of offending one, you know,
right,
another person.
Right.
You're gonna offend someone anyway, regardless. and so I think as chefs, as people in the food community, we have to continue to explore and push on. And not everyone's gonna be happy with one, you know, your decisions. But as a community, mm-hmm, we've gone this far, and we need to keep pushing on.
Yeah, sounds like you're talking from a lot of experience as one of those sort of innovating chefs. Speaking of, you know, becoming a chef in this country, you write in one chapter that you sort of had few role models who were cooking from their Asian heritage mm-hmm, growing up. And I love this quote, so I just want to quote you. You write, "I never understood why the Asian identity and the American identity had to be compartmentalized, the way my Salisbury steak and apple pie were separated in my Swanson's dinner. I wanted to eat them all in one bite." That's an excellent metaphor. But do you think that this has changed somewhat today when we look at the landscape of Asian chefs in America?
Yeah, I think it's changed, mm-hmm, in leaps and bounds. And it's incredible.
It's so fast, right?
When you see the evolution of a thing happen right before your eyes, which I've just witnessed it, you know.
And you're no doubt part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, you're no doubt part of it too, right?
Yeah, maybe. I kind of look at it from, you know, either I'm within it, then I can't see sort of the forest for the trees. But you know, I remember a time when this used to be my biggest pet peeve, right? Because people would go, so like you're cooking Asian food, right? And I'm like, what does that mean? What's Asian? That's an entire continent. Like, do I go up to you and go, hey, so you're like a European chef, right? Like you just cook European food. Because you'd never say that. You'd never go like, yeah, I'm an Occidental chef. You know,
right.
It's like, oh, I cook Italian food, I cook French food, I cook Spanish food. But you know, like, you go and you know, people would open restaurants and go like, Asia Grill. And I'm like, what does that mean? You have you know, 40 countries in Asia and, you know, you can throw everything
which
on a grill.
Yeah.
To the point where we've come full circle and we've seen people go, you know what, I'm going to not only cook Chinese food, but I'm going to cook Szechuan food. And I'm going to take that and I'm going to sort of blend it with different, you know, American ingredients, and we're going to sort of celebrate this whole thing. And so it's gone full circle, to, you know, there's a place in Lexington, Kentucky right now serving, Sri Lankan food, which is a very specific, place on the map. But also, you know, incorporating sort of the produce of the American South, you know, like that kind of stuff is so exciting to me. And again, I always say, you can't cook Sri Lankan food in Lexington, not the way it is cooked in Sri Lanka, because you don't have the produce. You don't have it's not the same growing climate. And so what you do is you make adjustments and you adapt and you kind of improvise. And that's when this food becomes no longer about Sri Lanka, but it actually becomes about Lexington, Kentucky.
Yeah, and
that's to me, that's it. that's the most exciting kind of food that I get into.
Absolutely. And I'm so thankful for you providing recipes at the end of each of these chapters, because the descriptions were just so mouthwatering. And I definitely want to try some of these, and, you know, some of these riffs that you've created on your own, too. It looks like that's about all the time we have, unfortunately. But there's so much more to talk about. I hope everyone gets their hands on this book. You know, from the Cambodian restaurant you go to in Lowell, Mass., which I need to go to, you know, just right here in Brooklyn, Brighton Beach, and so many other locales. It's really exciting to see what may be in your town's backyard right now. So yeah, thanks so much for shedding light on those stories, Chef.
Thank you. Thank you for liking the book.
Absolutely. And I hope everyone checks it out. And what are you cooking tonight for Father's Day? Or is somebody taking you out?
I'm not cooking. I have to work brunch.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's Father's Day brunch, so okay. I'm actually a little late. But,
oh, no.
Yeah, well, I have to work at the restaurant for brunch. And then, yeah, I'm just going to, like, literally, I don't know, just eat leftovers. Or it's not very glamorous. My wife and daughter will make me something. Aww. Hopefully a cupcake. I've got a sweet tooth.
Nice. So. Well, I hope that turns out well, and thanks so much for joining us. Have a great
brunch service.
And thanks everyone here at Heritage Radio. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. Never had no loving like this before.